Kutcher's Country Club sits in the heart of the Catskill Mountains, 2.5 hours from New York City, in what Charlie Wilson affectionately calls the Hebrew Himalayas. Kutcher's is a high-priced family hotel, and every Yom Kippur holiday throughout the 9 years of the Afghan War, Art Alper made it a point to spend time there with his aging father. The conversation at the dinner table at Kutcher's in the fall of 1983 was hardly scintillating. Two old ladies who had taken a shine to the CIA man's father always seemed to find seats at the Alper's table. The women didn't pay much attention to the 58-year-old youngster with the yarmulke and the pot belly and the ample jowls, and anyone looking at this table would have assumed that the younger Alper was about as boring a dinner companion as could be imagined. But Art Alper was a man who made his living surprising people, and his head was alive that fall with the deadly assignments he was beginning to work on for Avrakatos. For 30 years he had specialized in the creation of nasty and often lethal devices. His division, with its joyless bureaucratic title, the Office of Technical Services, had given Alper the best window in the business on the full range of covert operations the agency had pursued over the years. When the agency wanted a chemical to make Castro's beard fall out, or a poison pen to assassinate him, Alper's colleagues in the Office of Technical Services got the call. Almost any time the CIA undertook a daring or dangerous operation, it invariably required some devilish input from the OTS. Despite Alper's nondescript grandfatherly appearance, he was an adventurer, a man with an eye for the ladies, a lust for travel, and a love for his work. In the 1960s, this eminently forgettable-looking man had been given the assignment to direct the Covert Action Division of the CIA's Office of Technical Services. He spent a year in Laos, helping run the secret war, and 3 years in Vietnam, with 13 devilish tinkerers serving under him at the old Saigon embassy. There he was given carte blanche to play dirty with the Viet Cong. One of his favorite tactics was to secret both a homing device and Semtex plastique into typewriters offered for sale at shops the Viet Cong were known to frequent. Alper was then able to follow the typewriter by its signal and identify the enemy nest. When ready, this American with the kindly face would detonate the Semtex charge with an electronic signal, striking a blow for the war effort. Alper loved this work. But then the war ended, and the Church Committee investigations all but wiped out his beloved specialty. By the time the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, the CIA no longer had a stable of deadly tinkerers to call on. Not only had many of the old covert operators been fired, but the storehouse of ingenious gadgets to support special operations was simply not there anymore. The task to rebuild the inventory was given to Alper, who began roaming the world in search of deadly hardware, dividing his fieldwork between Central America and Afghanistan. At that point, the Reagan administration was focusing its energies and hopes on the Contra War, where it believed victory was possible. Afghanistan was deemed a lost cause. So in 1983, Art Alper found himself on the Nicaraguan-Honduran border at the vast CIA Contra base camp known as Las Vegas, directing a most unusual operation. Alper felt it was critical to do more than just support the CIA's Contra army. Out to win the hearts and minds of the Nicaraguan people, he sold the agency on a plan that called for floating huge propaganda-stuffed helium balloons into Nicaragua. For years, the agency had tried to convert the communist Chinese by bombarding Red China with such propaganda balloons launched from Taiwan. For the Nicaraguan operation, Alper added his own grandfatherly touch by including little packets of candy, soap, toilet paper, toys, and toothbrushes in the aerial bombardments. Every Sunday, Alper would fly from Washington to Tegucigalpa. At 4 a.m. Monday morning, he would be at the border with his helium pump, ready to float his propaganda offensive into the morning air currents. Alper took particular pride in this effort. It filled him with a sense of American virtue, knowing that his little creations would soon be delivering their message of hope into the hands of honest peasants eager for a non-communist alternative. But then the CIA got caught mining the harbors of Nicaragua, and when John McMahon, the agency's cautious deputy director, reviewed the Nicaraguan operations, he grounded Alper's balloons. Congress had just passed the Boland Amendment, making it illegal for the CIA to do anything that might be aimed at overthrowing the Sandinista government. McMahon concluded that the balloon offensive might be construed as a violation. For Alper, the game was up in Central America. The only place left for the kind of vigorous anti-communist guerrilla warfare he loved was Afghanistan, especially now that Avrakatos was taking over the program. Art Alper was prey to an occupational hazard common among many of the CIA's specialists. He believed that only his specialty offered the key to success. The agency's mine expert, for example, had the same conceit, and by all accounts was virtually psychotic in pushing his belief that mines alone could inflict maximum pain to the occupying army. To Alper, sabotage via small portable devices that disable, surprise, and kill was the answer. When he first reviewed the Mujahideen's tactics, he spotted all kinds of ways to make a difference. Ambushing was the meat and potatoes of the Afghans' strategy, but their antique approach reminded Alper of old cowboy movies he had seen as a child. An Afghan standing up in the hills with a plunger connected to an explosive. The guerrilla in his turban or chitrali hat would wait for the tank to get to what he hoped was just the right spot before making the connection to drop and blow it up. The OTS technicians proposed as an alternative a small black device about the size of a Walkman and not much heavier. Alper still has a few of these blasting boxes on a shelf in his consulting firm office just outside Washington. Their most attractive feature, he explains, is that they are very light and user-friendly. Whereas a Mujahid would have to struggle to carry a bulky wood box and plunger up and down the mountains, these 6-ounce devices could be hung from a belt and used 10 times or more before requiring a change of batteries. Alper had discovered this blasting device for sale in Europe for $113. After taking it apart, he'd decided that he could have it made in the United States for about $90. It would look exactly like the European model, which was important in those days when American involvement had to be concealed. Even better from Alper's perspective, since he is a fierce Buy America man, it would put some Americans to work. Remember, he explained with genuine conviction years later, we were just coming out of the Carter years and there was great unemployment. Commissioning a U.S. company to arm the Mujahideen called for breaking the prohibition on American-made weapons. But in Avrakatos, Alper found a risk-taking, rule-breaking boss who figured that even if the Soviets did capture some of these little black boxes, they would never be able to point the finger at the CIA. And what was the KGB going to do even if they found out? Sue us? Avrakatos says Alper was something of a bureaucratic misfit, somewhat adrift in the agency until he put the technical expert to work. He's fat and people passed him over. He was only a GS-14. Some of his ideas were off the wall and we'd have knockdown, drag-out fights. But 2 out of 10 of Art's ideas were great. Gust also maintains that some of the work Alper ended up doing on the Afghan program advanced the tenets of modern conventional warfare. Bear in mind that Avrakatos was talking here about Alper's efforts to design ever more lethal ways of killing Russians. He'd sit down with the Egyptians and design some new plastic device that the Soviet mine detectors couldn't detect. When the Russians made plastic mine detectors, we made screaming memes. We'd put steel rods on the side of a hill and make the limpet mines look like stones covered with mud. It was all point-counterpoint, and Art always knew the counter to the counter and had started to build it. Here was this 58-year-old guy calling me at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night saying, "Hey, I've got a great idea, can I come over?" You can't get that enthusiasm out of a 14-year-old.